You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Amazon and Airbnb are similar in many ways. Both are, at least in part, software companies whose inventory is simply a set of entries in a database accessed via a website. Anything can go into a database. For Amazon's books, it might be Harry Potter or a self-published obscurity or anything in between. Airbnb's database for New York has included over 1,000 hosts who have never had a review, and at least one host who listed over 100 properties. It is easy to pick a few items from such a database and spin a story of the kind of business it is. The long tale starts with the story of Touching the Void, a book that languished in obscurity until reviews by Amazon readers pushed it up to the bestseller list. And we have already seen the stories that Airbnb builds around its hosts. Beyond these structural similarities, there are parallels between Anderson's vision of the future of business and Airbnb's shared city manifesto. Both evoke simpler, more personal pre-industrial times. Cities are the original sharing platforms, writes Brian Chesky. But over time, they began to feel mass-produced. We lived closer together, but we drifted farther apart. But sharing in cities is back, and we want to help build this future. Both Anderson and Chesky select the most uniform aspects of bricks-and-mortar culture as their reference, the chain bookstores and the chain hotels. Given these parallels, looking at how the industries identified in Anderson's long tale have developed us, help us to see how sharing economy is likely to evolve. And it turns out that a decade after Anderson published his ideas, the era of the hit is not over after all. Blockbusters are alive and they are well. One of the most thorough books at how the entertainment industry has actually developed over the last two decades is provided by Anita Elbersee in the book Blockbusters. Companies that own Web 2.0 platforms themselves are blockbusters. There are several factors that make digital markets winner-take-all in structure. Amazon is not just the biggest online bookseller in the USA. It is the biggest by a massive margin. And digital markets are often global. Walmart may be huge in the US, but its attempt to expand around the world have met with only patchy successes. But Amazon is the leading online retailer in major markets throughout the world. Other
online services such as Netflix and iTunes are similarly global. Also, as Elber Cerci shows, the major digital platforms such as Amazon and iTunes have decided to build blockbuster products into their businesses in a big way. When Lady Gaga decided to pursue a massive launch strategy for her 2011 album Born This Way, she partnered with Amazon to sell 440,000 copies of the album at a discount price to take its sales over 1 million units in the first week. 3 years later, Apple famously provided everyone with a copy of U2's Songs of Innocence in their iTunes music folder, whether we wanted it or not. And Netflix is investing heavily in its own blockbuster content, mass-market TV series that it owns. The focus on blockbusters extend beyond individual promotions. Google CFO Eric Schmidt, who wrote an enthusiastic blurb on the cover of The Long Tail, changed his mind within 2 years. In 2008, he said, "All of the tail is very interesting, and we enable it. The vast majority of the revenue remains in the head. And this is a lesson that businesses have to learn. While you have a long tail strategy, you'd better have a head, because that's where all the revenue is." Elber Cerci quotes Schmidt as admitting, quote, "It's probable that the internet will lead to larger blockbusters and more concentration of brands. When you get everyone together, they still like to have one superstar. It is no longer a U.S. superstar. It's a global superstar. So that means global brands, global businesses, global sports figures, global celebrities. Overall, after looking at patterns across multiple cultural industries, Elber Cerci concludes that, quote, as demand shifts from offline retailers with limited shelf space to online channels with larger assortments, the sales distribution is not getting fatter in the tail. On the contrary, as time goes by and consumers buy more goods online, the tail is getting longer but decidedly thinner. And the importance of individual bestsellers is not diminishing over time. Instead, it is actually growing. The technology that promised to undermine mass production and bring a new era of personalized niche culture has instead found itself returning to the blockbuster. There have been conflicts, notably between Amazon and the major bookshelf publishers, but these are disputes over who gets to keep the money generated by largely by authors and artists. Open source promised to create a democratized alternative to the world of commercial software, but instead found itself a part of the commercial landscape. Web 2.0 platforms promise to create a more egalitarian world where artists can connect directly to a global audience, but they have ended up giving us more blockbusters. Just as open source programmers make their code freely accessible to others, so many in the technological world pushed back against other forms of enclosure in a cultural world. Copyright was the most prominent legal mechanism for restricting the distribution of cultural content, and the appropriation by the big record labels of most of the proceeds from the music business made them a target for opposition. The story of Napster's rise and fall is well known, followed by a proliferation of BitTorrent-based file-shared sites for films, TV shows, and music. Some celebrated the rise of the pirates, who saw themselves as populist opponents of big business, just as the free or lib open source hackers saw themselves as opponents of Microsoft and other proprietary software companies. Companies such as Google tried to walk a fence between the two camps. Copyright violating music videos were one of the drivers for YouTube's success. But Google also wanted to make money off YouTube that demanded cooperation. The issues around copyright, culture, and digital technologies have been explored in countless books and articles. So here I will focus on just a few parts of the story that have parallels with the sharing economy. In his book, 2008, Remix, law professor and influential open culture advocate Lawrence Lessig argues in favor of more liberal sharing of cultural works. His books adapt a golden age view of history similar to those of Curtis Anderson and Brian Chesky described above. There was a time, writes Lessig, when amateurs and professionals alike both consumed and created culture in suitably binary terms, he calls these read and write activities. But then came the mass production world of the 20th century. Quote, never before in the history of human culture has the production of culture been as professionalized. Never before has its production been as centralized. The 21st century, driven by digital technologies, promises a revival of participatory culture, a swing of the pendulum back to a more healthy balance. Healthy because the internet enables a wider range of people to speak and gives a new literacy to amateurs who can create in context that before only professionals ever knew. Lessig advocates what he calls hybrid economics, where internet platforms enable sharing and selling to coexist side by side. It is a vision with parallels to the way that open source has come to exist alongside proprietary software, and it finds echoes in the sharing economy, where people make, quote unquote, a little extra money, rather than having full-time jobs. And just as Lawrence Lessig argues that it is time to jettison a regime of copyright built for a radically different technological age, so sharing economy advocates that the laws surrounding taxis and short-term rentals are outdated, made obsolete by new technologies. But just as Web 2.0 platforms have found that blockbuster strategies still make sense, so Lessig's promotion of participatory platforms has delivered less than it promises when it comes to democratization. There is a difference between open source software and open culture in the world of software development. Many of those who contribute to open source projects have a steady income from their programming work, whether it is for open source contributions directly or for complementary activities. In cultural industries, the situation is different. It's not obvious where artists will make their money if their work is made completely open. As a result, cultural creators, some of whom were entranced by the example of open source and the possible digital distribution offered for connecting directly with their audiences, these have become increasingly disillusioned with the Web 2.0 world. In 2008, activist singer Billy Bragg wrote a New York Times op-ed piece about his experience with Michael Burch, CEO of the social network Bebo, who had just sold the business to AOL for $850 million. When Burch approached Bragg to set up a Bebo, he had big plans for musicians. He was hoping to expand his business by hosting music and wanting my advice on how to construct an artist-centered environment where musicians could post original songs without fear of losing control over their work. Following our talks, Mr. Burch told the press that he wanted Bebo to be a site that worked for artists and held their interests first and foremost. In our discussions, we largely ignored the elephant in the room, the issue of whether he ought to consider paying some kind of royalties to artists. After all, wasn't he using their music to draw members and advertising to his business? Social networking sites like Bebo argue that they have no money to distribute. Their value is their membership. Well, last week, Michael Birch realized the value of his membership. I'm sure he'll be rewarding those technicians and accountants who helped him achieve this success. Perhaps he should consider the contribution of his artists. Copyright is the tool of the major record labels to appropriate the money in the cultural world. But anti-copyright can also be used to expropriate. YouTube and iTunes both benefited from cheap or even free source material. Making content free is good for the digital platforms, but apparently not so good for the artists themselves. One of the most articulate analyses of how the anti-copyright movement has lost touch with those it claims to support is delivered by filmmaker and activist Astra Taylor in her 2014 book, The People's Platform. As anyone who makes a living from her art, Taylor has grown increasingly skeptical of those who identify artistic creation with amateurism and who advocate making artistic creations available for free to gain exposure. Looking for money-making opportunities elsewhere, concerts, conferences, t-shirts, consulting, depending on your creation. Opposition to copyright conveniently pushes questions of payment to one side. But those who make the arguments are often not short of a penny or two. Law professor Yuk-Chai Benkler tells us that, quote, money isn't always the best motivator, unquote. And media professor and successful author of copyrighted books, Clay Shirky, reminds us that, quote, the essence of amateurism is intrinsic motivation. To be an amateur is to do something for just for the love of it, unquote. A publication of the Harvard Business School argues that a decline in industrial profitability won't hurt production because artists' unique motivations will keep them churning out music even if they're operating at a loss.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC. But it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We're looking at excerpts from the book What's Yours Is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy, by Tom Slee. Taylor's book vividly captures the problem for artists in a world of openness and sharing. When she found her documentary film Examined Life posted online soon after its premiere, she wrote, quote, a present note that began in a tone of gratitude, thanking the various uploaders for their enthusiasm and support for the project. Then I told them that the movie had been quite costly to produce, and we were about to release it to theaters and to home viewers. I'd like a few months, I went on, to try and recover some of the film's expenses by charging people to see it. Would they mind, I wondered, removing the clips in The Intern, unquote. Of the two people who replied to her note, one told her that since Taylor's film was about philosophy, and since philosophy belongs to everyone in the world, my film does too. The other said essentially the same thing, but with more expletives. The attitude to artists' payments brings Bertolt Verschut to mind. Amongst the highly placed, it is considered low to talk about food. The fact is, the reason is because they have already eaten. Creators, or is that content producers, who look to internet platforms as an alternative to the established industry, will largely find themselves as disappointed as Billy Bragg and Astra Taylor. A recent example is the relationship between Google and the independent musicians. Cellist Zoe Keating had built a YouTube channel as a promotional vehicle to build an audience and used YouTube content ID systems to claim a portion of the advertising revenues from videos that feature her music. But Google is changing its revenue model for YouTube and told Keating that if she wanted to continue using Content ID, she would have to sign a new services agreement, committing her not to release music elsewhere before she releases it on YouTube, to running ads on all her videos, and to numerous other rules. The content may be open, but the platform apparently itself was not. The rise of the amateur, of openness, and of free culture has not been at the expense of the blockbuster, but instead has led to a quote-unquote missing middle. Those who look to make a living in a modest way from their art or from their role in the creative process as booksellers, editors, and so on have found themselves on the outside of these changes. As Andrew Franklin of Independent Publisher Profile said in 2014, the large best-selling authors are taking a bigger and bigger share of the market. Just as in every branch of late post-industrial capitalism, the rich apparently are getting richer. New authors and struggling authors and mid-list authors are finding it harder. This is bad news for the average writer. They get paid less so that publishing houses can hold on to the best-selling with higher advances. The Web 2.0 platforms in the cultural industry have taken advantage of the winner-take-all tendencies of digital markets to make money from each and every transaction by advertising or by direct sales, and have used their position standing between the consumer and the service provider to build enormous market power over service providers. The dispute is often presented as one between scrappy startups and big corporate incumbents, Airbnb versus chain hotels in particular. And yet history suggests that these big players will find a way to coexist. Instead, those who are more likely to be hit are the smaller bed and breakfasts and independent hotels. And the new entrants, those who have had the promise of easy access to consumers dangled in front of them, may find that the platform they depend on takes the lion's share of the money. In addition to open source software and open cultural content, many claims about the benefits of digital openness have centered on the changes this has brought to public debate and journalism. Glenn Reynolds' book on blogging is called An Army of Davids, How Markets and Technology Empower Ordinary People to Beat Big Media, Big Government, and Other Goliaths. Newspapers have suffered, and citizen journalism in the form of blogs and social media commentary has become more prominent. But here too, the rise of the amateur and the embrace of openness have not led to the promised upending of powerful entrenched industries or to the democratization of debate. The last sentence of Matthew Heinemann's The Myth of Digital Democracy is, it may be easier to speak in cyberspace, but it remains difficult to be heard. The book was one of the first that actually collected and analyzed last data sets to investigate online trends in consumption as well as production. Heinemann looked at the links among 3 million American web pages together with the data showing how Google leads its users to political sites and concluded that, quote, communities of websites on different political topics are each dominated by a small set of highly successful sites. The scale of online central concentration is so profound, he argues, that claims the internet democratizes politics is highly misleading. For example, when it comes to blogs, quote, the top blogs are now the most widely read sources of political commentary in the United States, unquote. But these widely read bloggers are very few in number, a few dozen, and they are overwhelmingly well-educated white male professionals. The kind of voices that get heard in political discussion are the same kind that were hurled through offline media, only perhaps more so. The vigorous online debate that blogs provide may be, on balance, a good thing for U.S. democracy, but as many continue to celebrate the democratic nature of blogs, it is important to acknowledge that many voices are left out. Heinemann's data on patterns of centralism and centralization in American online and traditional news media leads him to conclude that online media is even more concentrated, a few outlets with a larger share of the traffic, than many offline industries, particularly radio. The biggest story, as in cultural production, the missing middle, a phrase Heinemann coined when he writes, quote, from the beginning, the internet has been portrayed as a media Robin Hood, robbing audience from the big print and broadcast outlets and giving it to the little guys. But the data suggests that audiences are moving in both directions. On the one hand, the news market is cyberspace seems to be more concentrated on the top 10 and 20 outlets than print media is. On the other hand, the tiniest outlets have indeed earned a substantial portion of the total eyeballs. It is the middle class outlets that have seen a relative decline in the online world. Moreover, it is overwhelmingly smaller local media organizations that have lost out to national sources. We're going to continue looking at this in more detail in future shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Tiny, precious Olivia Michelle. For her first 6 months, she will need only the nourishment provided by her mother's milk. But her mother will need the nourishment provided by a food bank. Do you need what your food bank can give? Can you give what your food bank needs? The food bank is for anyone who needs one. Visit the food bank near you to help and be helped.
You You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Broadcast.